So how do you usually get back here? Is there a bus?
If I was using public transport, I'd get the train from Limerick to Dublin, Dublin Sligo, and then get a bus from Sligo to here.
It's a pretty long day.
Can take about 7 hours all in, 7-8 hours all in.
Would you be going back in here now? Really looking forward to the next day you can go home.
Do you know what? It doesn't really bother me. You get some guys come in and they really affects them. They get really down and upset and bothered. And I'm that bit older. I don't have small kids running around like a lot of them do. It's kind of hard for a lot of them to leave partners with small kids.
Do you remember this drive?
Of course, it went on forever. Lochan House is the open prison and it's where Pat was for the last 12 months of his time in jail. It's way up in the wilds of nowhere in County Cavan, near the border. Pat had been out on temporary release for a few days, down with his mum in Limerick, and we said we'd give him a lift back up after the weekend.
It's probably one of the weirder things I've done, in a way. Like, I've never driven a prisoner back to prison before. It does make you think a lot about what prison really is and what it means to be there.
Would you like to go back to work for somebody again? Would you like to have a job when you get out of here?
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
I like the idea of being able to do something for myself now. And whether it works or not, I don't know. But like, if you told me 3 years ago or 2.5 years ago that I would have written a book or that I'd be sitting in this car talking to you, I'd have said you're fucking nuts.
Are you confident about the future? Because you sound very unsure.
I'm very unsure, I guess. I don't know. Like, I don't know what way things are going to work out. Part of me is scared shitless. Part of me is really looking forward to it. You know, I'm trying to get rid of all those reminders of what I was. You know, because I don't want to be that anymore. That's the big thing for me, is that I just don't want to be that anymore. Like, before, I wanted to be the man around town. I wanted to be rich. I wanted to have all the trimmings. I actually don't want any of that anymore. I just want to be happy. And if I'm doing something that makes me happy, that'll do me. And I suppose when you see guys in here getting out, you kind of go, oh, geez, I really wish that was me, you know? But at the same time, then I'm kind of grounded and level-headed enough to know that I still have a certain amount of time that I have to do. It is what it is. And I could easily sit there and wallow in self-pity if I want to. Like, it can come very easy to you when you're in prison.
From Wine Tavern Productions in association with Go Loud, this is The Gambler. Episode 7, Suspicious Minds.
It was a Wednesday morning. I'll never forget it. I got up. I had my bag packed from the night before. Tracksuits, t-shirts, the usual shit you'd need. And I got up. I remember I got a text message off my solicitor saying, where are you? I told her where I was. She said, stay outside because of COVID. We'll text you whenever you need to come in. And I remember it was raining. But it wasn't heavy rain. It was this, you know, this really light drizzle that really soaks you. And I just sit outside and I felt like I was sitting there for hours and hours and hours. I was only sitting there for maybe 20 minutes. The next thing, I just got a text, just simple text, come in, court 3. So I took my seat, judge came out and just basically, it was brief, it was short and sweet. He read out what he was giving me. He gave me 2 years on the match tickets with the guy on the train. And then with the second charge, he gave me 12 months. And then I was thinking, right, okay, well, that's not too bad because 2 years, obviously the next year is going to be concurrent. So it's going to be run in. And then he said, no, consecutive. So that meant 3 years. You know, that kind of started to kind of not scare me, but it just started to dawn on me that this is it now. Yeah, when you go into Limerick Prison, you come into a courtyard and every block can look down on the courtyard, and your windows in prison are like little metal grills that you turn a dial on and they open up. So you could hear them shouting at you out the windows and shouting at each other, ah, he's here, he's here, he's here. And you know,
did they know who you were?
Some did, yeah, because like I'm from Moira, so I would have grown up around a lot of people that have been through the courts and the prison system, you know, and I would have heard, look at him. It's your man from Moyross, fella that lives in the bookies, blah, all this kind of stuff. You know, it's just part of it, isn't it? Then when you go into the cell, there's literally nothing there. There's a mattress in the bed with a duvet, a 2-inch thick blue plastic mattress. They take everything you bring in with you. That goes into your locker in reception and that's kept. You get it back after a couple of days. You get a lot of guys that would make their prison cells kind of homely. They'd paint them, they'd put family portraits up, pictures, all that kind of stuff. I never did anything like that, ever. To me, it was a prison cell. It wasn't a home. You know, it wasn't something that I wanted to make myself comfortable in. And even to this day, I've never done anything to make a prison cell a warm kind of a place. Just don't think it is one, no matter what you do to it. Everything about it is haunting, I suppose. You know, there's certain sounds that'll stay with me for the rest of my life now. Keys rattling, doors banging. You become very aware of your surroundings and things that happen in your surroundings while you're in there. Over my time in prison, I would have been one of the, how would I put it, the go-to guys for my intelligence. Guys would come to me if they needed help writing letters, if they needed to read charge sheets, if they wanted to find out about prison rights and writing complaint forms, all that kind of stuff. I would have been the go-to guy for that in every prison I was in. You know, I've had a lot of bad experiences in jail, but I've had an awful lot of good ones too. And, you know, without having gone to prison, I've no doubt I'd be dead now. No doubt. And that's where I was heading, and I know that that's where I would have ended up. Because I was beginning to realise how futile everything I was doing was, but I had no control over it and I couldn't stop it. And the more I dug, the deeper I got. And I could dig for Ireland. Like, I just kept digging and digging. In that way, prison has been completely rehabilitative.
Would you think you've had the same experience if it had happened in 2016, or was it just...
I don't know, but I probably don't think so. Like I said to you earlier, I do think it happens when it needs to happen or when it's meant to happen. I don't know is the answer to that. I really don't know as to like that'd be like me saying the first time I was ever in court in 1989 for the 30 quid check that I stole, if I got locked up in 1989, would my life have been so different? And in ways I think, geez, maybe it would. And then I think, no, it wouldn't, because like I said, I'm pretty resilient. I'm pretty adaptable. And if I want to do something, I'll do it. And I'm mentally strong enough to do things. Actually, no, I think the answer to that is no, it wouldn't have made a difference. You know, it wouldn't have made a difference. This is, I'm now where I need to be and I'm now where I am because of what had happened. But I needed to go to prison. I needed to do it. I got great, great help in Port Leash with the counsellor there. She was an absolute rock. She did things with me from a treatment point of view that I never done before, and in treatment centres and that kind of stuff, looked at different things, looked at me as a person rather than me, the addict. It's easy to treat an addict. You just sit down and you tell them, do the 12 steps and live by the 12 steps and you'll be fine, and off you go. That's bullshit. They will help you, and obviously they're very good guidelines, but you have to know why you do things. You have to know the effect and the consequences of these things. And you have to be able to feel things too. And I never felt things. I never felt remorse. I never felt guilt about anything that I did before. Because like I said to you, I always had people bailing me out, or I always paid people back. And I always went, sure, look, they're not really hurt. It's only a few quid. I haven't had the time to reflect on that when I was locked up every night at 7 o'clock when I heard the metal door banging. And you're sitting in a little 12x4 room with nothing but your thoughts. You know, you have a lot to think about and you have a lot to process. It took me a long time to deal with the guilt that came over me literally like a flood when I was in there. Guilt for everything, like not just the crime, just guilt for how I treated people, you know, my family, my friends, people that I stole money from. And that was okay to deal with. And then one day she turned around to me and she just said, do you not feel sorry for yourself? Why would I feel sorry for myself? I was the one that was doing all this. But she went through the whole thing with me as well about self-respect and self-esteem. And she helped me get all that back. So I'm proud, you know, I can hold my head up. I can walk around that town today with my head up. And if anybody says anything to me, I'll just smile at them and I'll walk on. You know, I don't owe anybody anything. And I've done what I've done. I can't change it. But I've certainly learned from it.
So how far are we away now? A minute?
Literally around the corner.
Well, hang on a second. Let me put my hat on. Jesus. Hang on a second now. Land up to the feckin' in the door of the place. Me parked in the back. I'm going to keep the glasses on.
That'll be good.
And I'm just going to put my hat on.
And that.
No, I do get recognised in the hat, but...
No, it's tea time, so everybody is going to be down.
I'll get down.
Having the tea. I know, you'll be good. Everyone will be having their tea.
Yeah. Are we going to drop you to the door?
No, you're not. You can drop me to the school. That's where, as far as you're allowed, anyways.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the yellow bollards there. Point. I'll go.
Yeah.
And if you want me to do something next week, give me a shout.
Okay, we'll be in touch. Is it? Where's your bag? Is it in the
boot? It's
booth?
In the boot.
Okay, I won't get out.
Thanks.
I'll see you.
I'll see you later.
Bye. Good luck.
It's funny looking back on it now, but I think this trip to Lochan House was maybe the first time we ever asked ourselves, do we actually believe this guy? And it was March 2023, and it was really the first time we'd spent such a sustained period of time in his company. Like, we were with him basically all day, sitting in the car, having lunch, driving some more, hours and hours of driving, lashing rain all the way up to the far end of County Cavan. We'd a lot of time to talk, and Pat himself was very eager to talk. We covered a lot of ground and it felt like he was being very open with us.
After we dropped him off, I think we both had similar thoughts. He'd spent ages telling us about prison and about the things he'd done to get there. And we could see the position he was in, coming towards the end of his sentence, facing into going home, having to look after his mum, build his life back up from nothing. We could see how difficult and precarious that was going to be. And we both began to wonder, why is he doing this? Why is he talking to us?
So I don't know. Yeah, I think he has been more positive or something.
On other days.
On other days, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like as if he doesn't want to commit to even hoping that he's going to be okay. He doesn't even want to commit that far today. It's like It's almost a sense of doom there with him, I think. And yet he's talking. He might even be out next week.
Yeah.
But yet he's doing all these things as well. You know, he is doing positive things for himself and he's writing his book and he's thinking about what he can do in the area of campaigning for awareness around gambling and he's thinking about how he can put his dreadful experience to some good use. So that is all positive thought, isn't it?
Yeah. I think he's just... He's very intelligent.
Yeah.
And he obviously recognizes this as a problem that is not just affecting him, but it's going to affect a lot of people. And for whatever reason, he's bending his mind towards helping with that or contributing to it in some way. This is obviously, you know, talking to you, talking to me, this is part of that. He's more conscious now of having fallen off before.
Yeah.
And that's really... Because he's obviously felt before confident. He's come out of treatment and been like, I'm never going back. Then he went back twice.
Mm.
And so that's obviously weighing heavily on him at this stage.
That's for sure, yeah.
I think what he said about, you know, if he did go back gambling, the scams would follow. And the next sentence would be 6 years, 8 years.
Yeah.
There's just no way around it. Like,
yeah.
It would be bigger the next time. It's been bigger every time.
It's been bigger every time, exactly. Yeah.
He's trying to put barriers in his own way.
Yeah.
I'd see the prison as being similar to the treatment centres in many ways. It's a big barrier. Like, you cut yourself off from the world and all those triggers fall away. You can't depress anybody in these places, you know. They've seen it all before.
They're certainly not going to be impressed by a guy putting a few Robin hours.
No. That's not going to win you any friends. It's not going to make you look like Mr. Popular, the big guy in the room, you know.
Yeah, because it doesn't seem as simple as just a simple bet. That's the thing with him, that it's the addiction. There's a bigger issue there, and he's identifying it with the Mr. Popularity, the guy who's paying the bills, the guy who's entertaining, who's inviting, who's sitting at the head of the corporate table.
Yeah, he's got it all figured out.
Yeah.
That's what he is. Like, that's what the image of himself in his head is, or was. And obviously that just keeps crashing down on him.
He sometimes, always actually, brushes over the scams that, you know, they were only small, they were stupid, they were... Yeah. Nobody got hurt. I was going to pay them back. I was, you know, I did pay them back. I mean, he told us there today that he's of the scams. If we went through them, he paid nearly everything back. Yeah. Yet he shouldn't have paid back that last few bob because he got the same sentence anyway. Yeah, it feels a bit mixed up.
It definitely is. Like, I think that's part of what he needs to tell himself to be okay with what he's done. You know, obviously what he's done is not murder anybody, but he is an entire life gone by scamming people, like taking them for small things, like people close to him, people who are total strangers, didn't really make any difference to him. And that's why I'm interested to see what his family say, what his cousins and relations say.
I was really interested to hear what Pat's family and friends had to say about him. And I told Pat this from the start. We briefly met one of his cousins the first day we went to Limerick with Pat. And he told us from the outset that he had these friends that he's had basically since he was a kid. And they've stuck by him through everything.
I still had five friends that are still my friends today, that were my friends before all that, that know me better than anybody.
And I was always trying to organise a chat with these friends and any of his family that wanted to come along. I felt like it was, you know, the more the merrier. I was just very conscious of only having Pat's word to go on regarding his behaviour over the years, and I felt that his friends and family would make him more relatable, kind of like a more sympathetic character, and I thought they'd make the story that he was telling just so much more rich and interesting.
So we asked Pat about this basically every time we saw him over those first few months. By the summer, we were really anxious to do it, and eventually Pat arranged for us all to meet. And then he cancelled it. Something came up. People were away on holidays, something like that. And then we arranged another date, and that fell through. Finally, September rolled around. Pat was out of prison for good, and everything was arranged again. Saturday the 9th. That was the date.
A couple of days before, I think it was either on the Wednesday or the Thursday, I remember I was walking across Hampstead Heath in London. It was a super hot day. And I got a call from Pat to say he's been told by the probation service that he has to attend what he called a restorative justice seminar on Saturday. So he'd have to cancel our meeting. It was an all-day thing in the prison and there was no way he could get out of it. And I just did not believe him. At all.
We'd had 6 months of trying to get to know this guy, asking him all sorts of questions about his life. And I suppose we'd ended up feeling that he wasn't being totally straight with us. Lots of the things he told us weren't adding up. Lots of things he'd promised had never come through. And the relationship was a lot more strained than it had been.
With all that, the idea of talking to his friends and family had gone from being like a bit of colour, a nice thing to have, to something much more important, a way of confirming his stories, a way of finding out, one way or the other, if what he'd been telling us about himself and about his life was actually true. And when he called me to cancel that meeting in September, I really felt like I was being messed around. And I probably only realised then how little I trusted him. So I called Nicola and we talked about what we should do.
I was already going to Limerick that Saturday for something else. I'd already made my plans for the weekend to include meeting Pat and his friends. So I just said, why don't we go down anyway and see what we can find out? We know where he lives. We know where he's supposed to be all day. And maybe if we both go, we can figure out if he really is where he says he is.
So we arranged to meet in Limerick at 12 o'clock on Saturday morning. A few minutes before 12, my phone rang.
So you're not going to believe this. I'm just driving into Limerick, okay? Literally just driving into Limerick. And I'm after swerving in because I saw Pat standing at a bus stop on Musgrave Street, is it? And I've just pulled in outside the probation services. I can see him, and he's waiting for a bus. He's standing against the railway, so he can't see my car. I might just wait till he pops on this bus and follow him, see where he's going. So it's midday. What time did he tell us he was?
He said he'd be in the course from 9 until 4, so it's noon now.
Now here's the bus. I would imagine he's heading back to Moyross, Ian, so if you want to get your car out of the car park and head towards the house, I'll try as much as I can to follow this bus and I'll see if he pops off it, because he might of course go in for a drink. What time is the match at?
Ireland were playing Romania in the Rugby World Cup that afternoon. We knew that Pat was a huge rugby fan, so the match was something for us to bear in mind.
So 2:30 is the match.
Yeah.
So I happen to have passengers with me in the car for this very exciting surveillance operation, which has now become, I wasn't expecting this now at all. So I'm going to just do my damnedest to follow this bus. Now we know that he knows my reg, so we'll see how observant he is. He certainly isn't expecting me to be where I am at the moment. And I mean, this is just luck, for goodness sake. We could have been sitting around all day looking for this guy. And it just shows, you just happen to drive past him. Some days luck blows my direction.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, I'll be in touch in a few minutes, I'd say. Okay,
bye. In a few minutes.
Hiya. So he's on the bus. He went to the Savoy. Poor Kiva, who's supposed to be having a day out in Brown Thomas shopping, is on the bus with him.
Okay.
I see the bus ahead of me. I asked her just to hop on in case he gets off to go to a pub. So we're following the bus out towards Moyross now. So she's on it with him. He gets off. But basically, I'd say he's headed for home. He must be due home for a while, I'd say, before he's going out or something. Will we let him go into the house and then decide what to do, or do you want to try and approach him?
I'd say we let him go into the house.
Okay, right. Well, I'll see you up around Moyross unless there's a change of plan and he hops off to go to a pub. So, yeah. Anyway, we have eyes on him. You there?
Yep.
Yeah. So he's just got off the bus now. He followed Kiva a bit and sort of backtracked on himself, but we're in Moyross.
Where exactly is he?
Yeah, he got off, I'd say, in a park.
Okay, so he's going to walk up.
He's on the phone and he's carrying an orange bag. Just, I'll tell you what, can you see the house from where you are or what?
Yeah, I can, yeah.
So, what I was actually going to do is drop the girls back into town.
Our work is done.
So you stay put, Ian, and I'll...
He's just gone into the house now.
Perfect. Brilliant. Okay. So I'll drop the girls into town, I'll come back out this way.
Yeah.
And we'll decide what to do.
He's up to something.
It does feel that way, and I don't know if that's just the feeling of him being someone that you just can't really trust because of his history.
Look, let's be black and white about it. He's cancelling things.
Yeah.
He's telling lies. So, you know, you've got that history there anyway.
Yeah.
So there's something to it.
Basically, I'd imagine for someone like that, in a situation that he's put himself into with us, he really should be being like extra careful to be upfront.
I would have thought so.
Because realistically, he must know that, like, if things seem off to us, we're going to try and figure out why. And I don't know if he's just so confident in himself.
But Ian, he has been 3 years in prison planning whatever this is he's doing.
Yeah.
That's probably the longest time ever that he has not been able to scam or gamble.
Yeah.
And he's been planning something. At this stage, we'd begun to think that maybe Pat was using us. Back in March, driving home from the prison, we'd speculated about his reason for talking to us. We thought it was maybe a way to keep himself honest, to make sure he didn't slip back into his old habits when he was finally released. Writing his book, making this podcast, putting himself under the spotlight, we thought it was some kind of insurance policy. If everyone knew what he'd done, he was less likely to do it again. But by September, our feeling about the whole thing had changed.
He's a great big plan. He's going to come out on this podcast as a story of, you know, redemption. And somebody who is the go-to man for anybody wanting to know about gambling addiction and what it can do. He's won his two literary awards in Listowel, and they're going to translate into him publishing a book with the same narrative. And again, the book so far that we've seen it doesn't tackle the crimes. It just tackles the gambling by and large.
Yeah.
But he wants to be employable as this sort of spokesperson for the anti-gambling industry or whatever. He wants to meet the minister. He wants to be in front of the minister in order to give his opinions, which are so valid in his mind, on how any legislation around gambling should be tackled.
Yeah.
So where do we fit in? I know exactly where we fit in.
Yeah.
Where we fit in is that he has seen the success of The Witness.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to be the next redeemed soul.
Yeah.
Who is loved, revered and admired as much as Joey O'Callaghan.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks he can do the podcast his way. He's getting cold feet.
Well, he's getting cold feet because he's realised now, or is maybe beginning to realise.
He's beginning to realise
the situation he's put himself in.
Yeah.
Because he's asked us, he talks a lot about, like, you know, he's doing this for no money. You know, he's just putting his time in good faith to make this happen. And, but what he's asking us to do is to stake our reputations on his testimony.
Exactly.
And I think maybe he's begun to realise that that was much higher stakes than he thought he was playing for.
I think so too.
I wonder if it's a sort of double or nothing kind of situation, because there is no, I don't know if he's banking on if all falls apart, we just pull the whole thing. That we'd be too embarrassed to put it out there.
I watched the house until the Irish rugby match kicked off. Pat had gone in 1:45, and by the time I left, around halfway through the first half, he definitely hadn't left again. There was no way he was at a restorative justice seminar. He was just at home, probably watching the match.
We realised that we'd have to catch Pat in a lie. If we just let the day go by and then ask him about it later, he'd have some excuse ready for us. So we had to catch him there and then, lying to us. We didn't want to approach the house because he'd see us coming and because his mother was there. We didn't want to make any kind of a scene.
So we settled on a phone call where I'd ask him how his day went. Very simple, but hopefully effective. We just needed to know for sure that he was lying to us. Knowingly and willingly lying to us. Everything depended on that.
So there's not much else we can do except for the phone call later on today and see what he has to say for himself.
Yeah, I'll call him at 4:00 and see what he says.
Yeah.
I'll call you and let you know.
Yeah, let me know.
But you can't leave a message for this number. Goodbye.
Hello?
Hi, I'm sorry, I just missed you there.
Yeah, how are you getting on?
Good, sorry.
How did you get on today?
Grand. It's just a stupid fucking thing, but it has to be done. So I have to do what I'm told, basically, until they tell me not to do it. All about a restorative justice thing that
What was involved, like?
They speak to you about how to make things up to people that you've harmed through crime, by means of, like, writing to them, apologising to them, making financial restitution where applicable, all that kind of thing. It's all about making amends to the people that you fuck over, basically.
Mm-hmm. Useful to you or not?
To be honest with you, probably not. Insofar as I knew most of what was going to be kind of said in advance, but it makes you think all the time, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still, long day to be in there in a hot day all afternoon and everything.
I wasn't in there all afternoon, in and out, so I finished it around 3:00.
Did you get to watch the match then?
Didn't I? I got the last 20 minutes of it when I came home. Did you watch it?
Yeah, I caught the second half there, which was A bit of a stroll, by the looks of it.
Yes, it was always going to be.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't ever going to be anything else but a bit of a stroll. Give me a ring on Monday or Tuesday when you have 100% on that.
Yeah.
And I'll tell everyone else then.
Yeah, we'll do.
Great. Right. Thanks, Ian.
Bye, bye.
How are you?
Not too bad now.
How did you go?
Yeah, I called him there. He was eager to be off the phone.
Right.
He didn't pick up when I called him.
Yeah.
And then he rang me back straight away on a private number.
Right.
And it sounded like there was stuff going on in the background, but he definitely wasn't hanging around. I asked him how he got on today, and he was saying, you know, kind of a load of shite, really. I asked him
he said it was a load of shite.
Yeah, I kind of asked him to explain what it was and, you know, what was involved and all that kind of thing and whether there was any use to him and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
And then he wasn't saying very much. Like, it was really kind of dragging it out of him. And I was like, well, it must have been a long day, you know, very hot, being in there all afternoon.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I wasn't really in there all afternoon. I was in and out and I was done by about 2:30, 3 o'clock.
Right.
And and I was like, oh, do you get to watch any of the match then? He's like, yeah, I got the last 10 minutes when I got home.
Right, okay, so he told you a lie.
Yeah.
Okay, phew. That's bizarre.
Yeah.
Very bizarre. So, what's going on at all?
I don't know, but he's definitely lied to me now.
He's definitely lied. He's lied flat out to you there. The fact of the matter was, as much as we could see until 3 o'clock there, after 3 o'clock, there was no friends, there was no pub, there was no course. He was finished and standing at the bus stop at about 10 to 12,
yeah,
trying to get home.
Yeah.
So, and that's where he's remained for the afternoon. He's just told a load of lies.
Yeah.
So
we have that
that's
now.
That's it.
We know that Pat lied to us that day in September. It was the first time we knew for sure that he wasn't being honest with us. The first time we'd actually caught him lying to us. In a way, it was a relief. We weren't crazy. Our instincts weren't totally off. We didn't really know what it meant for the podcast, but we knew we had to find Pat's victims, as many as we could, and see what they had to tell us. We had to put their stories and our own to Pat himself. We had to confront him with the truth.
The Gambler is produced and presented by Nicola Tallant and me, Ian Molini. The executive producer for Go Loud is Owen Brennan, and Darren Cleary is the commissioning editor for Go Loud. Sound design is by Neil Kavanagh. The Go Loud promotion, design and video team for The Gambler is Roisin Riley, Siobhan Walsh, Cameron Rooney, Andrew McConnell, and Dara Murphy. Legal support was from Mars Solicitors. If you have been affected by any of the issues raised in this series, you can contact Gambling Care on 1800 936 725 or visit gamblingcare.ie.